The Sunstone Theological Society presents Homeschool, There Is an Alternative, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Elizabeth Hall, and I'm moderating and participating in a panel on homeschool, just so that you know you're in the right place. I'd like to introduce the panelists. I'll start on my left and go to my right. Roger Wise is the president of the Utah Home Education Association, has many other credentials, and is also a practicing homeschooler. To his left is Sherry Thomas, who is a practicing homeschooler, and she has a degree in, let me look down here, she has a BA from Brigham Young University. She worked in the public relations department of the
University of Utah.
She got her BA at the University of Utah. and she worked in the public relations department of the church, had many of the LDS church, had many interesting experiences there. To my right is my daughter, Zina Hall, of whom I'm very proud. And to her right, and she's a practicing homeschooler. To her right is Gary Knowles. Gary is actively involved in research on education right now at the University of Utah. He has interviewed 40 Utah homeschools. Is that correct, Gary? He is a native New Zealander, an architect who became interested in education in general and homeschool in particular, and has several degrees in education, and is finishing, I understand, a PhD in education here at the University of Utah. He was the principal at a secondary school in Fiji, where there, when his older children were younger, there wasn't a school for them to attend, and they schooled them at home, and that was one of his initial experiences that interested in homeschool. The first panelist to speak will be Roger Wise. In fact, they'll proceed in the order that I introduced them. First, Roger, then Sherry, then my daughter, Zina, who asked me to tell you that she's going to read a short statement that she wrote about homeschool, and then Gary. I'm going to begin. My name is Elizabeth Hall, and I have had a school, a homeschool, quote-unquote, for the last 7 years. I'd like to start by kind of setting homeschool in maybe a mythical, philosophical, and historical setting. There's a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolution, which documents pretty persuasively the history of science as being not a smooth progression as most of us have been taught to believe, that, you know, one idea, one important scientific revelation proceeded smoothly from another. He says that instead, transitions from one major outlook to another were cataclysmic, and that there was always a period of upheaval before there was a change in the ordinary outlook about, you know what I'm trying to say, that when a paradigm was replaced, when one paradigm was replaced by another one, that this was not the smooth transition that we've sometimes been taught, but that rather there was a period of extreme disorganization between one viewpoint. And now that's familiar to us too. That's really just as familiar to us. You know, we hear about how when one of Tchaikovsky's symphonies was performed, there were riots in the streets and that sort of thing, you know. So we really understand that in everyday life. But we haven't been taught in school how things have proceeded. Well, I believe that this theory that he propounded about the history of science applies to other things as well. And I happen to think that we're in one of those transitional periods when many of our common assumptions about authority, you know, about expertise, about history itself, when many of our most common assumptions about morality, about so many basic things that we live with, and certainly about education, are really in a terrific state of upheaval and even chaos. And we seem to be in one of those times when there's a major shift, and nobody knows exactly what the outcome is going to be. Well, one of the characteristics of that kind of a time is that all kinds of ideas abound. You know, when you don't have a common idea, when people don't share the same, then you just have many, many different kinds. That's always true too, but those the ideas that don't go along with the temper of the times are submerged. Usually, they're not. There are people who hold them, but nobody listens to them, you know. But right now there's another thing going on, and that has to do with the history of our notions about authority. And, you know, we came out of a time when authority was vested in a king or a monarch of some kind. And the United States of America represented a big shift away from that kind of paradigm to a democratic ideal. But even in the United States, of course, we didn't practice perfect democracy. I mean, when the Puritans came, they were just as authoritarian and just as autocratic as any monarch had been. At least what I'm trying to say is their notions about authority really hadn't changed that much. They still relied on their experts to interpret the Bible. But see, the break had already been made. That couldn't hold up. Democracy began to take over. And we have more or less progressively moved towards a greater and greater degree of democracy. Now, this is very simplistic. There is so much more that needs to be said about that, but I am speaking simplistically and in generalities here. About the middle of the 19th century, all of a sudden, the old authorities were really gone. I mean, you still had the king of the monarchs of Europe, but they simply didn't have the kind of power that they had once had, and it kind of left a void, and it was filled by experts. When people rely on authority, then they need authority, you know, and so they couldn't rely on their kings or even their religious leaders in most cases, and so this void was filled by as people, Europeans and Americans, we created our own authorities. Scientists, doctors, educators, we sort of created this authoritative elite. And ever since then, now we've come to a time where we're working that out, when we find that we can't give them the allegiance either, you know. Now, this is my personal viewpoint, and I must state that right at the beginning. There may be panelists who disagree with me about this, but this is just a framework to set it in. And I want to say right at the start that homeschoolers are there is as much divergence of opinion among homeschoolers there is in the world, you know. I mean, there are homeschoolers who want to reinstate authority to its proper position and who feel that the schools just haven't been able to do that. So you see what I'm trying to say, that I represent one viewpoint, but really homeschoolers are a very divergent group and have many, many different viewpoints. And we hope to sort of, you know, get to that today. Now, I'd like to talk about my own personal experience for a few minutes. I started homeschool about 7 years ago. Can I borrow this, Sherry? Mine slid down on the floor or something, or else I put it between a page. In my case, I remember the first time I ever heard of homeschool, and that was about, well, my daughter's 17, my older son's 18, and so it was before he started kindergarten, and a friend of mine suggested, she was visiting from out of town, and she had children at about that same age, you know. So she had a daughter that she was contemplating putting into kindergarten within a year or two. And she said that she might keep her home and that she might school her at home for the first several years. And to be honest, I was quite shocked. In fact, you know, I was so shocked that I didn't say anything because I thought that I would be rude to her. And then over the course of the years, well, at the same time, I have to tell you that I hoped for great reform in our educational institutions. I felt that my own, I had some opinions about my own experience growing up. I'd been a very good student, got a scholarship to BYU, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know. But looking at myself and my friends, I felt that there had been some bad effects from some of the aspects of our schooling, my contemporaries, you know. And I hoped that those things could be changed in our schools. And as my own children went to school, started school, I began to realize that that was not a real possibility, that there might be small changes, but that there would not be the kind of change, which didn't seem all that big to me, but which turned out to be overwhelming. You know, I could see that the schools were not going to be able to accommodate that kind of change, at least not without some kind of outside pressure, you know, which wasn't on the horizon. So that little seed of an idea that was planted by my friend became more and more attractive to me. And then I had a friend that I admired very much at the place where we were living, who was about 15 years older than I, and so, you know, she'd already been through it. And she regularly took her children out when they were in fourth, fifth, or sixth grade. She took them out for a year. This was in California. And because she'd had a lot of success with her six children, she was often called upon to speak at stake firesides and that sort of thing. And I always felt like I got really good, sensible advice from her. So because she took each of her children out for a year and described the great benefits of it, this was another factor in changing my mind about homeschool. And so I came to the point where by the time my oldest was in about third grade, I really believed in the idea of homeschool. There was other information that I had come across too. But I had, you know, I was having a child every year and a half or so. And I imagined that was something, however desirable it might be, that I simply could not do, would never be able to do, you know. As much as I might want to, I just believed it was an impossibility. Then my son, in the fourth grade, he did the whole fourth, fifth, and sixth grade math course that year in fourth grade. He just ate it up, you know. It was just his thing. Then in the fifth grade, they had him do it again in the first half of the year this time. So in the middle of the year, his teacher called me and said, "Mrs. Hall, I just don't know what I'm going to do with your boy," you know. And I said, "Well, let me think about it." And I called him back and I suggested that I provide a book that he could use at school during math time and that then I would help him with it at home. And this teacher had 38 students and no help, you know. And the idea, just that simple little thing of him bringing in another book was so overwhelming. He just said, "No, I'm sorry, you'll just have to do it all at home," you know. He couldn't, I don't know what he planned to do with my son during that time, but anyway, he couldn't handle it. So, and then I tried to find if there was something else that could be done for sixth grade. I mean, I was really scared, you know. And there were other things going on, too. The fact that they spent so many hours in school that they couldn't do the other things that they were interested in, you know, which I felt were valuable, too. And so, and anyway, checking around about sixth grade, there was just nothing available for him in the place where we were at the time. And at this, now I'm grateful because that was the impetus that I needed. I just felt like I felt like it would be better for him to be home and do nothing than to go back there and just be bored sick, you know. So I decided I would take him out for sixth grade. And at that time, I just thought it would be this one-year thing, you know. And Zina instantly said, "If he gets to do it, I get to do it too." And I believed that Zina loved school. If anybody had asked me how Zina felt about school, I would have said that she loved it. And I asked her later, a couple of years later, you know, "Why did you never say anything about these feelings you had about school?" She said, "Oh, well, because it was just an impossibility to do anything about it. You just had to go. That's all there was to it, you know." no sense talking about it. You just had to do it. So I really feel that the first great benefit that homeschool has provided for our family is to make us feel that we are in charge. That the schools, the public schools that do exist, are for us. I mean, you know, you get that feeling that you're for them, you know, that you exist to create, to fill their assignments, to meet their, you know. So for us, that was the first great benefit, is that we realized that the public schools were there for us. They were to serve us. And that if they weren't serving us, that we needed to do something else. And so it was a traumatic adjustment, I'll be frank, those weeks before we actually did it. I'd like to just be all calm and cool and collected and pretend that we just did it smoothly and that it was very, you know, this was the thing to do and so we did it. But it wasn't the case. It really, we had a lot of emotional upheaval doing this. But the first week into school, you know, everything just dropped off us. We just felt such a relief that the trauma was over, you know. And for me, I still occasionally feel little pangs or little, you know, oh, I'm going to have to prove something to somebody. I'm going to have to justify what I've done. But those times are fewer and fewer. You know, I mean, I don't think I felt that way this whole past year. I would like to finish just by reading some things from John Holt. John Holt has written extensively about education, and he has published a book about homeschool. I don't know how many of you are familiar with John Holt. But while I differ with him in some particulars in his theories and philosophies, I sort of consider him my mentor in how to go about working with children. So this first part is a paraphrase, and then it goes into a quote. Was there ever a society so obsessed with learning as ours, so full of talk about how to learn more or better or sooner or longer or easier? Is all this talk and worry a sign that something is seriously wrong with us? Do vigorous, healthy, active, creative, inventive societies, Periclean Greece, Elizabethan England, the United States after the Revolution, spend so much time talking about learning? No. People are too busy doing things and learning from what they do. That's the paraphrase. Now the quote. More and more people are writing about ways in which people by themselves, with families and friends, in their towns and neighborhoods, can act directly and cooperatively to get what they need, instead of trying to persuade large, remote, uncontrollable, and increasingly unworkable institutions to meet these needs for them. This work of deinstitutionalizing people and society now seems to be perhaps the most fundamental and important political task of our times. John Holt says that, and that is something that I believe very much. And now I'll turn the time over to Roger for his.
Thank you. I'll relate a little bit about how we started our homeschool. We have five children. My wife and I have five children, 19 and 18, a couple of boys, and then we have two younger girls who are 13 and 11 now and an 8-year-old boy. When our boys were in junior high school, it was a small town. They didn't fit the macho mold in this small town in central Utah. I don't drive a 4-wheel drive truck that's 3 feet off the ground, so they didn't fit that mold. And they were having the brunt of some social pressure and some social violence. And so that was very disturbing to them and us. So we decided that we'd teach them at home for a while. At that same time, we just found out that we could do that, and so we did it. And it's been a very delightful experience for us. The boys were out a couple of years each. Then they decided to go back to high school and finish out their high school. When they went back to high school, they fit in extremely well. It was a different town. But more importantly, their self-concept was in place at that point. We took them out of the peer pressure, worked with them on the things, the values that we wanted them to have. We reflected to them our perception of what they were doing and how they were functioning, clarified their self-concept for themselves, and they're very well adjusted now, doing the things that they have chosen to do. One's in Brazil on his mission, the other one's supposed to get his mission call tomorrow, and that's why I'm nervous today, because that tells how much it's going to cost me for the next couple of years. Right now, we are homeschooling our three younger children, and they thoroughly enjoy it, and are doing extremely well. We feel very strongly that it's a positive experience for us, that our children are enjoying it. They're developing and growing in ways that we couldn't imagine them possibly doing if they were in the public schools, and they're in ways that we can help them to grow in ways that we choose, so our values are and our ideas are a lot easier to deal with them and to help them to learn about and deal with themselves as individuals. My wife and I feel that a very strong component of homeschool for us is our children's self-concept and their ability to make decisions, which is some of the things that we decided right when we first started to homeschool. We said, yeah, it's great, we're homeschooling. What do we really want to have our children be when we get finished with this whole process? And for us, it was and still is the ability to make independent decisions based on the facts as they have them and be able to gain the facts that they need to make a decision. And that has been very enjoyable for us and our family. It's a big part of our family, and we do a lot of things in conjunction with homeschool. As the president of the association, maybe I could say just a little bit about the status of homeschool in Utah and the homeschool in the United States. It's a growing movement. 7 or 8 years ago in our annual convention, we had about 250 people. This year we had about a little over 600 people. There are approximately, and it's very difficult to find the exact numbers, about 2,000 students in Utah homeschooling. That's a guess. Probably a little bit conservative, but there are a lot of people that do it. In the United States, the best guess that I've been able to find that's been published is somewhere between 100,000 and 250,000 students in homeschool in the United States, which would put us approximately average numbers, average percentage of students out in Utah. Legally, and you may have some questions about all these things, I'm going over them quite quickly. Legally, it's very easy to do it in Utah. We have consciously and conscientiously made our goal to cooperate as much as we can with public schools as far as legalities and who's responsible for who and how we get into any kind of hassles with public schools. We have a situation in Utah where we have some of the, I feel, and not having gone to all the other states, but just in the reports that I get from people coming from other states, we have one of the very best situations and climates for homeschooling here in Utah of any state in the United States. Currently, there is no problem with any school district in Utah, and all the school districts that I know about have dealt with accept homeschoolers. And in fact, we have tried to help them realize that homeschooling is a legal right in Utah. And your best bet as an educator, if you're truly concerned about children, is to cooperate and help these people in any way that you can. And most of them do it very well. We're doing some things to develop that are very exciting and will open up the opportunity for parents to deal with their children more effectively in their schooling, even with the public schools. And that will be coming out, I guess, within a year, and hopefully that'll be able to be implemented in across the state, and I suspect that it'll go across the country as a philosophy that we can do in cooperating with the public schools, and that's very exciting. Homeschoolers are very independent people. As Elizabeth mentioned, we have people that feel, for example, in curriculum that it needs to be very structured, and people that feel it needs to be very unstructured, and we've tried to make our association responsive to that. We don't tell people how they should do it. We don't tell people that they need to do things in a certain way, except the very few things that need to be done in a certain way. But we encourage people to establish their own ideas and decide what they want to do. So we have a very independent, basically free-thinking population in our association. there are lots of other things that we could talk about, but I'll stop now and let Sherry tell you about herself.
Thank you. I wish I had all of the experience that Roger does. I don't have children that old and haven't been at homeschooling as long as he has, but we have enjoyed it so much. It's fun to see two of my high school friends here that I haven't seen for years and a friend from the mission field. I just wanted to say that I had never dreamed when I was in high school or any other time in my life of homeschool because, for one thing, I didn't know that anybody did it. The first time that I ever heard about it was after my husband and I had been married for about 2.5 years. I was expecting our first child. Our oldest is 6.5 now, so officially we've been homeschooling for 1 year, but I feel like we've been doing it since she was born, since we were lucky enough to hear a tape of a man's dissertation when I was expecting her. My husband donated regularly to the Freeman Institute, which is now called the National Center for Constitutional Studies, and Cleon Skousen, who was the founder of that organization, would send out a monthly tape in appreciation to people's monthly donations. I would listen to the tapes, and I thoroughly enjoyed the speakers, and one of them was Reed Benson, who is a professor down at Brigham Young University and who had done his dissertation on homeschooling. When he decided to do his dissertation and got into it, he came home one night and he said to his wife, "I'm afraid I can't really do justice to this dissertation unless we do homeschooling." He says, "We just can't talk about it. I just can't look into it. We've got to do it." And so on this tape, he described her reaction as she was aghast and said, "Oh, I couldn't do that." And they had 8 children. And as they started, plunged into that year, and of course he was there to help her because that was part of his work, and that was nice to have that teamwork. But their children haven't been back to school since that time because it was such a wonderful renewal to them as they got into it and finally realized the things that could happen as a family, the closeness they had and the peer influence dropping off and the intense interest of their children to go into depth in various subjects and to not have to be interrupted at a given time because a bell rang, but they could really start into something and really get their teeth into it. So this tape went on for about 1.5 hours, and I listened to it. I remember one day when I was doing the dishes, and I was just thrilled to death. I thought, I had never realized that people could do that. I loved school myself when I was in school and enjoyed it very much, but I did feel frustrated that sometimes I couldn't get into the depth of things that I wanted to or that I had to do certain little notebooks in order to get a certain grade, and I felt a little frustrated that way, though I never thought there was any other way. But at any rate, I wasn't sure how my husband would react, and when he got home and listened to the tape, he felt exactly the same. And we found out we had just missed one of the conventions of the UHEA. We hadn't heard of the organization that Roger is the head over now. And so we called up the people who were then the president and leader of that organization, Lori and Ken Huffman. And I asked them if I could come out to their home. I said, "I'd like to talk to you about how you homeschool. I'd like to meet your children. I'd like to see where you teach them. And if you don't mind me being snoopy, I would just like to see a real-life homeschool." So we went out to visit their home, and probably the strongest single memory I have from that experience is visiting with their children, one of whom was a teenager and one was 10 or 11. And instead of me interviewing those children, they interviewed me. One of them came up to my side and she said, "Well, what do you do?" And I told her that I was a writer and I would write commercials for radio and television, which I was doing then. And, "Well, that's interesting. Well, how did you get into writing?" And I told her. And she said, "Well, what do you do on a regular day? And how do you know what to write?" And from a child that was 11 years old, I thought that was quite interesting. For one, that she wasn't shy at all to talk to me. It was a strange adult to walk in the door. And two, to show that kind of an interest in an occupation that was far beyond where she was. But anyway, my impression was the same with many other homeschoolers that I visited. And so when our first child was born, my husband and I kind of outlined a curriculum, even from birth, of the kinds of things that were important to us, our philosophy of education. And we both saw education as a pathway that we're going down, and we, as homeschoolers, have the great opportunity of being able to be like a traveling companion to those children. And we would be able to be the ones to share with them the excitement when they'd see a new idea, to help them to see something along the wayside that they weren't noticing, and sometimes to have them run ahead and to pull us and say, "Look at this," and for them to be the leaders. But to me, I just thought, I never want to give that up. I never want to not be there when my child is discovering things. And so that's been and has continued to be our greatest excitement and thrill with school. My hardest thing with homeschooling is trying to get the housework done because we have so much fun just learning. And I don't want to sit down and do some of the other things that I need to do just for orderliness. But we have a 2.5-year-old, and she has caught the excitement of the 6.5-year-old and wants to do phonics with us every morning as we go into that part of our curriculum, and has recognized all the letters and is proud to know the sounds of things. And she wants to play the violin, and so she started playing the violin about a month ago, and she can't play any songs yet, but she can play the rhythm, and she knows where she's supposed to put her hand, but she feels a part of things, and she is excited about the things that her sister's excited about, and they play together very well, more so than I see a lot of children with that age gap of 4 years, because they don't know anything else. They don't know about being in with just a certain group that's exactly your same age all of the time, and they love each other. They're just great equals, and my biggest one teaches my youngest one all the time, and she accepts that teaching. And there's just a wonderful spirit there. Everything that I'd hoped and dreamed for, if I can overcome some of my problems and just being organized. We're expecting our third in December, and they already talked to me not just about the things that they're going to do to take care of that baby, but the things they're going to teach it. So I know that that's their orientation, as it has been ours. So I guess I'll turn it over to the next one.
When my mom asked me to be on this panel, first I enthusiastically agreed, and then later I wondered why I had, since I am bored with talking about education. I am especially bored with the questions about homeschool that people seem to always be asking me. These people are either threatened or thrilled by the idea of homeschool, and in either case, they want to talk about it. These conversations can easily go on for hours, and as I said before, it bores me almost to tears. Of course, I had the same symptoms of excitement and fear that these people have when I started homeschool. On my first day of homeschool in 1981, I was terrified. I thought someone was going to come get me and take me to jail, or worse yet, back to school. I used to start a lot of conversations about homeschool back then. It was an important issue to me. I'd use arguments for homeschooling that I'd heard my mother use, and I'd try to explain to people why homeschool was so much better than public school. I don't think I ever did convince my best friend, the A student, but I sure spent a lot of time trying. Gradually, my interest in the subject of homeschool diminished. As with my newfound freedom, other interests grew. I learned to swim and to dance, things that I'd been afraid to try. I became interested in parties, music, and boys. I learned to speak French. I helped with school plays and acted in a couple of them. I kept a journal, and I sang in a choir. Whether or not these new interests grew out of my being in homeschool is not something that can be proved, but I am quite certain that they did. I was very shy, and being in homeschool gave me a chance to figure out what it was I wanted to do and the courage to try it. I took classes at the high school when I was ready, taking only electives at first and later more difficult ones. There are still many subjects that fascinate me that I've never had time for, and I'm looking forward to a lifetime of learning. A system of individualized education has worked so well for me that I no longer need or want to discuss it. So, why am I on this panel? I have to admit that having total silence while I talk is an incentive, coming from a family of 9 children, as I do. But I also wanted to provide an example of someone for whom homeschool has really worked, a homeschooler with plenty to do, plenty of friends, and no more than my share of personality quirks.
My orientation to homeschooling is very different from that of the previous 4 speakers. Let me explain. Some early readings in education, and sort of relative to homeschool, led me to believe that perhaps it was a good idea to hold children back and not send them to school at age 5. I'd read materials from a number of authors on that topic, and towards, I guess, the mid-70s, I read some work of Raymond Moore, who happens to be a homeschool proponent. And one of his books was titled Better Late Than Early. And in that book, he proposed that that parents ought to hold their children back primarily for advantages in self-esteem, and perhaps advantages in socialization, and perhaps to let children simply be children. And while I don't necessarily agree with Moore's philosophy and many of the things that he writes about, I do think that particular book was a useful and important springboard. In about the mid-1970s, I was principal of an alternative residential school on the main island of Fiji. It was a fairly large school. I had students from age 8 through to 22. In that school, my children didn't fit in. The lower grades were taught in Fijian, and my children were obviously native English speakers. And so at that point, because of geographical isolation, in other words, they weren't able to attend school, we homeschooled them. So they were schooled for 2 years at home. That homeschool experience was probably very different from many school settings. Primarily, we taught through discovery, experiential learning, lots of hands-on sorts of activities. So by the age 8, my two eldest children were back in public school, and I was in another setting and continuing teaching and working in schools. Today, I am currently involved at the University of Utah in educational research and in teacher education. In fact, for the last 10, 12 years, I've been heavily involved in teacher education. So I have this paradox, as it will, in my life, in that, one, I support homeschooling, particularly in my case, and the flip side of the coin, I support public schools. And I see an important niche for both homeschools and obviously for public schools and private schools. I arrived in Utah about 1982. And you'll recollect that even back in 1982, there was a lot of talk about the Singer case, and of course homeschool was still mentioned. Now, and that drew my attention to homeschool in Utah, and initially I felt, yeah, homeschooling must be different in this state. So I began to read a lot about homeschooling, and I noticed some of you squirming. I don't know whether there's any reason for that, but anyway, I read a lot about homeschooling. And it seemed to me that in this country in particular, there was a very observable series of phases. There's always been homeschooling to some degree, but particularly in the late 60s, early 70s, we see some sort of takeoff point where increases in people involved in home education occurred. These people began to homeschool primarily because of contentions they had with public schools. Those contentions were due to a multitude of reasons. Interestingly, those contentions by the late 1970s were leading to confrontations with courts, with school authorities, and there were obviously many court cases involving homeschool parents. Interestingly enough, by the early 1980s, we see some sort of consolidation in the homeschool movement, whereby homeschools become a little more, if you like, recognizable, a little more public. We see a beginning of networking, grassroots organizations emerging that support homeschool parents. And by the mid-1980s, we're beginning to see some fairly active cooperation of homeschools with public schools. And of course, that came in the light of the fact that most administrators lost court cases against homeschools, and the courts essentially mandated schools to consider cooperation with homeschool parents. And of course, that leads us to the situation here in Utah, where homeschools are pretty much, or homeschool parents and their children are pretty much accepted by school districts, and school districts are interested in working with homeschool parents to a greater or lesser degree, and often, of course, that depends on the willingness of parents. Interestingly enough, I perhaps see that another period might emerge. I'd like perhaps to call that a contributory period. I would imagine that somewhere in the near future, because there's a certain freedoms allowed in homeschools, I wouldn't mind placing a bet on it, if you will, that there'll be some interesting outcomes of homeschools that may in fact benefit public schools, but that's just a little forecast. So around 1985, I began a longitudinal study of some homeschools in Utah. I've been involved with, I think, about 43 homeschool families, many of which I've spent long hours observing, others in which I've had other people observing, interviewing, talking, and soliciting a lot of information about those families. And so it was my purpose then not to get information about homeschools from surveys, as many other researchers have done, but to get information by actually being in the home. And in fact, there's one, I noticed one person here this morning who was one of those families that I visited. As I said, my purpose was to explore and to find out, to describe what these homeschools were like, because in fact, I felt that unless I could do that, I wouldn't be able to understand what they were about in this state, at least. And so I guess I need to relate to you some of the things that I found out, but I'm not particularly or purposely trying to do that. I ought to say, first of all, that homeschooling in Utah is really like homeschooling in every other state. And indeed, there is a large growth of homeschooling in most Western countries. I'm a New Zealander. There's a large number of homeschool families in New Zealand. There are also large numbers of homeschool families in Australia, South Africa, England, and other European countries. I think perhaps the Utah orientation, or I guess I ought to say the Mormon orientation to education, perhaps in some way has hindered homeschool development in the state. And some of you may be surprised to say that, to hear me say that. I think it's because, in fact, LDS people have largely very much supported public education and see that as an expression of their allegiance towards democracy and towards the country. And so I think in some ways homeschool parents in Utah have had a more difficult time than in some other states. And yet conversely, at this point in time, homeschooling is, as I said, very much accepted. What do homeschool parents look like? What do homeschool families look like? They're very difficult to characterize. I think you'll find them from all socioeconomic groups. But of course you need to understand that in most cases one of the parents doesn't work, which means therefore there's obviously a reduced income. Homeschool parents go out of their way to a considerable degree to educate their children at home. They're very concerned about their children's well-being. So they tend to be middle class, but not exclusively. They tend to have religious orientations, but not exclusively. We find homeschool parents anywhere from the far left to the far right. My sense is that homeschool parents are more like everyone else in the community than they are not. I would also like to just talk very briefly about some of the reasons that homeschool parents are involved in educating their children at home. My sense is that many of them have contentions about public schools. And often those contentions aren't just contemporary, but they seem to be perhaps also historical. That is, they're a product of individuals' biography. Many of the homeschool parents that I've talked to had unpleasant experiences in school. And that, coupled with possibilities of unpleasant experiences for their children, have elected to homeschool. But, you know, apart from that, though, there are issues of control, issues of protection, issues of nurturing, family unity that are very important for homeschool parents. My sense is that there are many advantages of homeschools. The homeschools that I see are often very good educational environments. But, like public schools, I would venture to say that there are some homeschools that perhaps are not as good as others, some homeschools that excel in what they do for their children, and others that are fairly marginal. But by and large, I think, you know, they do provide an appropriate environment for some children at some period of their life. And certainly, it's not this. People often ask me, you know, would you recommend homeschooling? And I would simply say no. I would say no, and then I'd qualify it. And my qualification would be, if it fits the need of your family and your child, then yes, consider homeschooling. If it doesn't have the best interest of your child at heart and of your family, then obviously homeschooling isn't for you. And there are many families who won't be able to do that. I think, importantly, homeschooling may in the future be a vehicle for allowing greater parental involvement in public education. I think homeschool parents, more than anything, provide a very good model for other parents to get involved in the education of their children, either by supplementing their children's education at home or by helping out in schools. And I would like to conclude simply by saying that for my children, homeschooling was a valuable experience. My oldest son is graduating from high school in November. He elected to finish his education in New Zealand. He's in the top 2 percentile of the country in the subjects that he's involved with. He claims, and these are his words, that homeschooling put me on or set me in a direction of which I've never looked back. I'm not sure whether he said that for my benefit or whether he really believes it, but he did say it.
Thank you. I had a couple of general notes I wanted to talk about before I turned it open for questions. And I can't remember the second one, so just one. UHEA, by the way, because there is sometimes confusion about this, is an unofficial organization of homeschoolers. Homeschoolers, of course, wouldn't have it any other way. But occasionally there's a misunderstanding that arises where somebody believes that the UHEA was an organization formed by the state school board or something to handle homeschoolers. But it is, in fact, a spontaneous organization of homeschoolers. So just with that note, then we'll open it for questions. If you would like to direct your questions to a particular panelist or else to me, and if you don't want to take responsibility for who answers it, then I'll choose the panelist. Yes? You know, my husband told me, he said, you better get an answer to that question. So, because that is always the first question. I mean, just invariably. Would somebody else like to answer that question? I'm really bad at answering that question. Okay, good.
Everyone wants to know what a day in the life of a homeschooler is like. I almost put that into my little paper that I wrote. Didn't have time to add it on. The thing is, a day in the life of a homeschooler is just a very difficult thing to say because, as you say, theoretical, it's largely life. It's not, you know, it's not from 8 o'clock in the morning until 3 p.m. you do a certain thing. It's what you're interested in. For me, a typical day in homeschool is like a typical day for me has been during the summer. I go and do things that I've arranged to do because I'm interested in. I took French and biology and other things at the high school. I go shopping. I do things that I'm interested in. I spend time reading. And I don't organize it a certain way by, you know, hours, what I'm going to do, unless there's a whole lot of things I want to fit in. And then I say, okay, 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, I'm going to read this book because otherwise I'll never get a chance. But everyone does it differently. And that's the thing. With homeschooling, you don't have somebody else telling you how you're going to structure what you learn. You go from your interests. That's how I've done it. So,
yes, Roger.
In response to that, in as much as homeschoolers are very independent, they do things their own way. You find everything, the whole gamut. Typically, as a homeschooler starts out, they will try to replicate a public school classroom because that's where we're coming from. After a while, that gets very intense. Sometimes it takes a couple of days. Sometimes it takes a few weeks. Sometimes it takes a few months for that intensity to build up to a breaking point. And then, typically, homeschoolers will just throw that all away and sit back and relax. When we did that, we knew that was coming, and so we just sat back and and read The Secret Garden with our children and just had a thoroughly enjoyable experience. And that's what we did all day long, and we didn't really do very much else. Then as we picked up on the things that we felt, the amount of structure that we felt comfortable with, that my wife felt she needed to have or didn't want to have, that became very tailor-made to our family. And so after people go through that transition period, they end up with something that is anything from school is jumping in on the parents' bed in the morning, sitting around reading scriptures, The Secret Garden, physics, whatever the kids are interested in, to talking, all the way, and that ranges all the way to a very structured classroom-type situation where the kids study math from 8 to 9, and from 9 to 10 they study English. And that is so individualized that it is very difficult to say, but it's a very pertinent question. You make it what you want to make it, and you have the freedom to do it the way you want to do it.
I'll let Roger address that now. One thing I would like to say first is that one of the biggest shocks when you first start homeschool is how much less time it takes to cover the material that you're supposed to, that you're quote unquote supposed to cover, than it does at school. I mean, there's just 2 hours would be too long a day.
There is no official accountability. The accountability comes into play in that the parents are vitally interested in it, and they demand that their is met, and their criteria usually is at least up to the public school standard. But no, there's no official criteria. There's no official follow-up. We don't have to prove anything. There are some legal requirements about the amount of time we spend in homeschool and the subjects that we teach. There are no competency requirements, and so you're pretty much up to yourself. Most homeschoolers who do it for the right reasons, and most of them who do it for the wrong reasons, quit very soon and go back to public schools. So we find that it's a self-governing process, and you do it because you want to, and your motivation is your children and your family, and so it's self-governing.
There was a question here, and then we'll go from there. Yes?
I've been homeschooling for 4 years now, my children, and too much. Sometimes they come in here, and they just get wiped aside.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of the second comment that I wanted to make, and that is, if you have some resource that you'd like, send a card up to the front. For instance, the address and phone number of the UHEA, or a bibliography of books about homeschool, send a card up to the front with your name, address, and phone number with it, and I will see to it that you get directed to what you want. That was the other thing I wanted to say. Okay, now, I believe you were next.
You were talking about not being accountable to anybody. You're talking of Utah, or would that be
any state? That's basically Utah. Each state has its own setup.
I come from Idaho. Where would I go?
In Idaho, they have been planning to organize, and I can give you the name of a homeschooler in Idaho that could give you some guidelines on how to do it in Idaho.
There's more around Idaho.
Everyone's been doing my own better. Yeah, I've heard about how he taught his children.
Okay, the question is, I forgot that this is being taped, and we're supposed to repeat the questions. The question is for Gary and his experience teaching his children when they were young with hands-on kinds of activities. Okay.
One of my major orientations to education is that of an outdoor educator, meaning I believe that those things that I can teach better inside, I ought to teach inside. Those things that I can teach better out of doors, I ought to teach out of doors. So that means that the curriculum that I would organize, or did organize for my older children, was such that if we wanted to learn about trees, the forest, we might first read some books about trees, forests, plants. We'd then go and look at trees, forests, plants. We'd smell them. We would climb them. We'd look at them. We would, find seeds. We would find old trees, young trees. We'd get a sense of what the forest was all about. And we would do that in a way that might be game-like. And then we'd come back and we'd write stories about our experience. We may read some more books. We may then go to an encyclopedia. And I need to explain that at this point, my son, who when we began was 6, had a reading age of 15, so he was already well into stuff that was very advanced, and that was in part, I believe, because of his homeschooling. So we could use a lot of very advanced resources that, you know, other parents may not necessarily be able to use because of the point in development of their child. So it was very much a sensory, kinesthetic, experiential learning environment. Now, I've said that really very short, in a very short space of time. We did a lot of field activities, a lot of things out of doors, other places in the community, other people's places, at workplaces, wherever. Wherever was the place that we wanted to learn about, we would try and go. How did I teach? I didn't try and teach them history. Okay. My view would be that we would approach points of interest, almost like, almost as it were, like threading a set of beads, a necklace. You know, you place on one bead at a time until you make up the necklace. And you know, at this point, for example, the children may be interested in butterflies, so we would go helter-skelter into butterflies. And by learning about butterflies, we would do math, we would read, we would write. You know, we would learn some science. So, you know, history wasn't ever a topic of that I taught them. If we went to a local village, then you know the history would come up. You know, well, how did these people do this in the past? And so we would talk about history, and we'd maybe talk with older people. So my approach is very holistic, and I'm not interested in particular subject matters.
My son, who's 14 and was 13 last year, obviously, we had planned a trip to Mesa Verde, and he didn't want to go because somehow the word history had come in there, and he said that he hated history, you know. And I didn't contradict him, but I just started to talk about what we would be doing there and what we would be seeing. And he said, well, that's really interesting, and he wanted to go then, you know. And I said, well, did you know that that was history, you know? And he looked at me wide-eyed and said, it is? Anyway, as a passing thing. Next question. Yes. Yes.
One of the old arguments, I know you've heard it a lot, against homeschool has been socialization of the child. And I know that my high school experience sent me back about 10 years, I figure.
In your social experience, you mean?
Yeah. I was an A student, no problem.
Yeah. In our case, we didn't have to, and I think that's probably true of most of the panelists. I would like Gary to address that question.
Interestingly enough, the question of socialization was the one in which school administrators brought against homeschoolers, particularly in the late 70s, early 80s. It was the question that led to court cases. Interestingly enough, my sense is that the question of socialization is a mute one. In other words, it really holds no value. Unless you have your children and you teach them in isolation. Now, families don't live in isolation. You know, families communicate, families socialize. And so in most settings, the question of socialization doesn't really have any bearing. You go to church, perhaps. You go shopping. You visit friends. You have kid neighbors over to play. You know, you're socialized. What happens is that you're socialized in a more controlled atmosphere. In the school setting, you're socialized by your peers primarily. Adults and teachers have fairly little influence. In the homeschool setting, the main socialization agents are siblings, parents, and other adults.
There's some quite a deal of evidence that children are stronger socially if they're in a more protected environment up until the age of about 8 or 9 rather than 5 or 6. And that there is some evidence that if they are somewhat more regulated and you know, to use that dirty word, isolated, which isn't really what it is, but just more regulated, that then past that age they are just simply stronger and and make their own choices about how they're socialized. The UHEA has a good deal of information, and also that's if you'll send a card up stating that you would like more information, then I'll make sure that you get some.
Does the UHEA have meetings at regular intervals where people who are in homeschools can network with each other?
Yeah, the question is about what UHEA provides for networking and for support. We have a phone number that I'll give to you, 488-3676. It's really an answering service, and you'll have an option to find out what you want to get. We have an opening packet or a beginning packet that costs $3.50 that we'll send to you. And it has a lot of the answers, tries to answer a lot of the questions about homeschooling in a written form using some of the best, highest-faluting authorities that we can find. That's for people who respect that kind of authority, and that's useful at points, especially for in-laws and grandmothers. We also have annually a state convention. It's held the first part of June usually, and it really is a renewal for all of us, and it's a wonderful time. We have workshops on all kinds of subjects and all different ends of the spectrum on different subjects, how to teach all different kinds of things. That's a very, very good time. We also have a monthly newsletter that Sherry is the editor of, and it's an excellent publication. It tries to deal with social interactions, networking. It tries to deal with legalities that are going on, new programs, socialization that different people want at different times. There are a few small subgroups where the parents get together on a monthly basis. So we also have in every school district of the state a homeschooler that is called the district leader. And that district leader's job is to know of homeschoolers and to be a resource for homeschoolers within that district and to provide or allow them to provide and structure social experiences if they want to do that, networking, somebody to talk to, somebody to scream at besides the kids, whatever is necessary, that's district leader's responsibility to see that, not necessarily to do it, but to see that maybe if a person wants to talk to somebody else who has kids in junior high that, oh, you can call this other person and you two can talk and be mutually supportive. Yeah, in Salt Lake Valley last year, they had a parent cooperative where they rented a building and they took turns teaching one day a week, I believe it was. The feedback that I got, it was very, very effective, and the parents and children really enjoyed it. So, you know, anything you can think of is a possibility for your child's education. And if you just stop and think about it a little while, there's so many things you can do that'll be so beneficial to that particular individual child at that particular time in his life. And that may be exactly what he needs. You can do it, and it's valid.
I'm going to name two books that I think are especially helpful to start out with. One is called Teach Your Own. The author is John Holt, and that is a survey of the subject, more or less. He has opinions, which he states too, but he has the experience of many homeschoolers in that book, and there's even a lot of legal information and so forth. It's just a good general introduction to the subject of homeschool. Another one is Homeschool, and that one, if you're interested in a typical day in the life of a homeschooler, that one is that's by Nancy Wallace, who's a homeschooler. That book was published, I think, in 1984, and she's drawing on her experience from several years past. That one is about that family's experience homeschooling. It's very interesting. Yes?
I'd like to add a couple of other books. I think two books which come to mind which are pretty inspirational in the sense that they record experiences of parents who have gone about homeschooling in creative ways. One is called Children on the Hill by Deacon. I can't think of his first name. It's a Michael Deacon, that's right. A story of a family in Wales. Another one is called Putting the Joy Back in Egypt. Putting the Joy Back into Egypt by Jean Harris. And it's published by Hodder Stroughton. Hodder Stroughton, does that sound right? It's an experience of a New Zealand family homeschooling. Both, I think, will give you some very diverse views of homeschooling, and ones in which I think can inspire you.
Thank you. I went to the BYU library recently to look up some things on homeschooling, and the computer catalog of books, which has books mostly from after 1978, I put, keyword, homeschooling, and I got a list just miles long. In fact, I have it at home. There are it's almost overwhelming. There really has been a lot written on the subject. Another question? Howard in the back?
Yes, I would like to know a little bit about a part-way thing, like if you can have your kids go for orchestra and go for PE and that kind of thing. And maybe I'll just tell a little bit about my experience. I've been very much for homeschool, but I haven't been able to convince my kids. They love school too much.
Hey, let it go.
So I went on to the step that the last man suggested. I went down and got involved in the school. I found out they didn't have a good gifted program, so I taught the gifted classes for the last 5 years at our elementary school and introduced them to future problem solving and all kinds of things. And then I moved on with my kids to junior high and taught the gifted class at junior high.
Yeah.
And kind of some before and after school life things. But I'd like to know about the part. Like if next year my kid has a really lousy history teacher, can I just pull him out?
Amen. Yes, you can.
History at
home? Yes. I'll answer that and then give it to anybody else who'd like to contribute something. We've had quite a bit of experience with part-time schooling in our family. To start with, I would say if you have a child who wants to stay in school, do not force them to go out. That's not what we're talking about. We're also not talking about the overthrow of public schools. Except my husband is. Yes, if your child is enrolled full-time in public school, in junior high or high school, and they have a terrible history teacher, yes, do take them out. There's no sense ruining that subject for them. Our approach has been that our children have gone to the junior high and high school classes that they've chosen to go to. And that scares a lot of people because they think they won't choose some of those more demanding classes. But our children have. The only class that I've ever insisted that they take was last year. Okay, well, because the oldest child, a brother, is a math whiz, I think the next two children were intimidated by that and whatever, socialization or whatever, but they just decided that they weren't good at math. So last year I insisted that they take a math class. And see, this is, you individualize it very much. There are some children that I think should not take math classes. But Zina, they both got A's, and Zina took geometry, and Mary took what? Pre-algebra? Algebra? Algebra. She took algebra. See, she's in charge. And they both got A's in those classes. So the approach that we've taken is that we don't have them graduate from high school, because then, then they have to meet somebody else's requirements. Now, if they choose to graduate, Mary believes she may want to graduate, and she's planning more or less on that. But otherwise, and by the way, I know the next question, can they get into college if they haven't graduated from high school, right? And the answer is yes. And do you want us to talk about that? Or
about scholarships?
My son received a full-time tuition scholarship to BYU. Now, he hasn't been admitted to BYU yet, but that's because he hadn't decided whether to apply or not. But he did receive that scholarship, so and that's almost another subject in itself, although we'd probably be glad to talk about it. Right. If you find, if a child or if a person finds that he needs to finish high school for some reason, it's very easy to do that. very easy. But many children every year are admitted to major universities all across the country without a high school diploma. It's almost routine. We've had some good, you know, the universities have had good experiences, by and large, with these kids, and so they've become quite open to it. Is that not incorrect? Yeah.
May I just say that know what you're doing, and you don't have to have a high school diploma at all. Even for the scholarships.
My son doesn't have a diploma.
Her son, there's a salient example here at the University of Utah. A young man got two scholarships, music and an academic scholarship, and you know that was just contingent on him meeting those scholarship requirements. But he didn't graduate.
Yeah. Yes. Right. This is what we need to address, isn't it? How you actually have your children attend public school part-time. And I can tell you, in Utah, and Roger, I'm sure, has more information on this, and I'll turn it over to him, but it really depends on your local school board and on your local principal. For a while in our school district, which is Alpine School District, my school district, I should say, the school board policy was for several years that it's entirely up to the local principal. And that policy hasn't been changed, but there are some new people on the board that we homeschoolers are sort of educating to. And so we have succeeded in having our... You can reassure your principal that it's done all over the state, that many children attend school part-time all over the state. Now, this is in junior high and high school. It's a different situation in elementary school. There haven't been as many children attend part-time, although I did succeed. When I told the principal at my local elementary school that the school board ruling was that it was up to the local principal, and he was a very good principal and a very good person, and he was very interested in the individual welfare of the children in the elementary school, and he agreed with me that it would serve my son's needs better to go a half day, and so I did have one son attend a half day in fourth grade, and we were able to work that out. So in junior high and high school, it's pretty well established. The precedents are quite well established, and you can get the information you need to do it. In elementary school, we're working on it.
And if there's an instance in the state where we run into a problem with a school district, we try to become involved if the parents want us to be involved as an association to try to soften that and have them adopt that policy. And it's been very successful, and most all school districts allow part-time enrollment.
If you have a difficulty with a school district, it is very wise to call the UHEA and enlist their help, because that you're able to avoid adversarial kinds of relationships by using them quite often. Yes? Okay, I have some comments on that, as usual, and then I'm going to turn it over to Gary. To answer the second question first, it is very individual. I find with some children that the question is, do you ever need to just insist that a child do something sometimes? And yes, I make a distinction between a demand and compulsion. I make many demands of my children. That is, I let them know that there are things I want them to do. But I only practice compulsion when it involves them injuring another person in some way, either physical or emotional or whatever. So I insist often that my children study a certain subject or whatever, but they don't always do it. And I find that it really works out much better that way, that usually they know themselves better than I do, with some exceptions. But here, what I'm trying to say is it is very individual. And most people who describe the process you've described, you were fortunate if you remember that material later, if you study for an exam and you get all that information into your head, you pass the test, and then most people promptly forget it. In those circumstances, you may be an exception, and that's it's just extremely individual. The first question was what again? Oh yes, I'll turn that one right over to Gary. from my point of view, no. But then, you know, I'm prejudiced.
I think realistically there are some disadvantages for some families. One major disadvantage might be reduced income. Another disadvantage might be obviously reduced time. I mean, parents don't have the same time necessarily. They may, under some circumstances, to pursue their own interests in their own social realms, if you like. So it is very time-consuming and it's a real commitment. Apart from those two disadvantages, the others are very idiosyncratic. In other words, they relate very much to the individual families. For example, I think in some families undoubtedly have a very narrow view of the world. That may be a major disadvantage to the child. Most don't. But I think, you know, we need to recognize that there are some that do. I think another disadvantage might be if the child isn't given a major say, or if not the say, in what goes on. For example, some parents seem to restrict the interests of their children based on what they feel comfortable with. So in some families that may be a disadvantage. My sense is that in most families it's not. Another disadvantage may relate to the sorts of resources that the family feels that they can put into education. For example, they may confine the children simply to the home without using the broader sphere of the community and the state that we have. And, of course, that may be a financial constraint. I think other disadvantages relate to the parents' willingness to be creative and innovative. My sense is that you've got to, if you're going to homeschool, you need to blow your mind, as it were. You know, be wide open to all sorts of possibilities. I mean, homeschooling can be an incredibly creative opportunity if you allow it and if you have the courage to, you know, go in ways that are diverse. And unfortunately, many people don't have the courage. Many people want to stick close by the structure of schools because that's what they're familiar with. So essentially then, I would say the disadvantages are largely idiosyncratic and depend on the circumstances of the families.
Thank you. My own biggest weakness as a homeschooler is the it overwhelms me sometimes, the logistics of getting all the children all the things that they would like and that I think would be good for them. And, you know, that bears out the idiosyncratic. For a while, I used to say that my biggest luxury was time alone in my own house, which mothers, all of whose children go to school, do have. You know, and so one year I sort of put them all back in school. There were other factors involved. I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't also felt that it met certain children's needs at that time. But now at this point, I find that that's almost superfluous. I have found how to have my own time alone to myself, even with a house full of people. But anyway, I don't know if I want him to ask a question or not.
Just a comment on her answer.
That man is very familiar to me.
Another comment on the previous comment, to disadvantages, you ought to be prepared, I think, if you pull your children out of school, to let them lie fallow for a year.
That's advice I often give, yeah.
It takes a while to realize that you can learn on your own and that you don't have to be taught.
All right, now Zina wants to say something, and then I would like... for an example of how you tailor what you do in your own home school to your own beliefs, feelings, experiences, and needs, I really would like Sherry to talk about her. You remember the things that we discussed, your experiences in public relations and in writing things that were to appeal to the public. I really would like you to address that for a few minutes. Yes? Sherry.
Well, it kind of relates to what I was going to say in response to the second half of your question about whether you have to force your children to learn certain things. When we first started sitting down at a table, we bought a little tabletop and set it on some food storage boxes, and that made a little table about a third as long as this table, down to a child's height and some little chairs. And And my ideal was very much like Roger said at the beginning, a mini public school in our little learning center. And I put up a sign, this is the Thomas Learning Center, and had all the equipment and all the shelves stocked. And this was our art center over here. And these were the biographies about Helen Keller and about Thomas Edison. And this was this. And my little girl liked that for about 3 days. We sat down at that table and we'd go through different books. And I'd say, okay, now we get out this book. Okay, now we do this. Now tell me what this is. And that did not work. That was too structured. That was too intensive, especially a one-on-one like that with me firing questions and she was the answer machine. So I thought about that for a long time, for probably a week or so, and tried to figure out how we could do it differently. And the first thing we did was to find out that what she most liked in the world was to be read to. As Roger said, they spent a great deal of time reading The Secret Garden at first. And I found that we could incorporate history and science into our reading in a very non-painful way. And it wasn't a forcing this, now we're going to study this, we have to know this. But as we'd open The King of the Wind and we'd see that it was set in Morocco and they'd be flying down the Great Atlas Mountains, and we could open up a map and look at that, and we could talk about what it was like when they'd go visit the boy king of Louis XV, who was reigning at that time, and what the kings wore and how they looked like and how come there were boy kings. And things that we would read that she loved. She loved the stories, and she loved different settings in different countries. And they opened up a doorway. Here was a new thing. We can look into this. We can find out about this. And history and science just poured out of those young children books that we read when I saw those opportunities and saw her questions and began to see that I was a resource to her. I was a help to help have her find the things that she wanted to find out, but then she got to find them out. And she started to learn how to use those books. And we started to study in our pajamas in the morning for an hour. And we started to study on the couch because she likes to sit on the couch, not at a table with a thing in front of her. And we had books in every room. Everywhere we had a bookshelf up to the ceiling with different things that we had accumulated so that wherever we were, she could grab out books and look at them. And we finally got to a point when she was about five where we sat down and set some goals of things that we thought we could mutually agree on that were very important as skills. She had been taking the violin since she was three at that point. And I could begin to see that there is a difference between factual information, understanding the world and the dominions and whatever we need to know, versus things that are actual skills that we need to work with. And skills that we need to work with, I believe, have to be practiced, such as learning to play a musical instrument, such as learning how to do math computations, and understanding a feeling inside of you about the gospel. To me, that's I wouldn't say a skill, but it's something that has to be on a very regular basis. And I'm getting around to answering what you said. But we decided to set down certain givens, and that every day she can make her selection of when she does them, and she can make her selection of what she's going to do. She sets down a goal. I'll do 2 pages of math every day. But it's her goals, and it's her decisions. And we've recognized that there are certain things that have to be that way and other things that can come in throughout the day and projects that she can get into. And as she got into the decision-making process and she told me what she was going to study, and we could agree at the beginning of a week and then see how we were doing each day.
Thank you. Our time is up, and we do need to clear the room for the next session. Thanks so much for your participation.